Ready.
Just in the middle of the field, 45, 50. Green grass in front of him, leaving Lions in his wake.
I am Jeff Joniak.
Blitz is on. Down he goes. Husker.
What was it like playing for Coach Ditka?
I don't want to answer any questions like that.
61 yards. A Sunday stroll for Justin Fields.
No way.
Now, Bears Etc. brought to you by Miller Lite with the voices of the Bears, Jeff Joniak and Tom Thayer.
Welcome back to the Bears Etc. podcast. We're episode 51, halfway through January already and gearing up for a memorable offseason as the Bears are interviewing offensive coordinator candidates and delving deep into their game plan for the quarterback position with Super Bowl winning Bears guard Tom Thayer. I'm Jeff Joniak. Good to have you along as we begin a now once-a-week show through the offseason, save for any breaking news, of course, that may occur between now and the start of training camp. And we are sponsored by Miller Lite, official beer of the Chicago Bears. Tastes like Miller time, Chicago. We have a special guest to kick off the program. Special guest on 51, it's our Dick Butkus episode for a guy who was born and bred Dick on the South Side, one of the premier chefs in the world right here in Chicago, our very own Joe Flam, culinary director for Sincere Hospitality, overseeing Rosemary and BLVD Steakhouse in Fulton Market District, winner of Top Chef Season 15. His career is amazing. We're going to get into that. His love of the Bears and the White Sox also deeply rooted in this man, and his world is blending with the sports world as we speak right now. Joe, how you feeling, buddy?
I'm feeling good. Feeling good. Excited to be here, guys.
Thanks for joining us. I know you have a busy schedule running everything, but before we get into all that, we got to get your thoughts on your beloved. We got to talk about the Bears. And, you know, hey, it's going to be an amazing offseason, and I know every Bears fan is feeling a little bit anxious about it all. How are you feeling about it?
Yeah, I feel anxious. I feel excited. I think these are normal feelings as a Bears fan. But I think, you know, I really like Kevin Warren. I really like Ryan Poles. So, you know, I think at this point you got to say we trust our guys, right? We trust the two guys who are there to do the job. I think, you know, I felt better about it before the Packers game. And then I felt better about it before I watched the Packers go to Dallas and absolutely destroy the Cowboys. It just kind of, that was the scary thing to me there, but I think it kind of forces your hand one way because you're now saying, you know, we thought the Packers weren't going to be this, right? A couple of years ago, we're like, okay, you know, they're kind of going down. Everybody's treading down in our division. Detroit went through the roof. Green Bay's making a run now. It's saying, okay, the table stakes are just as high as they've always been. So if we want to compete in this division, we got to be ready for it. We have to have, you know what I mean, the weapons to do so.
So the Bears lose to Green Bay 17-9 in Green Bay. They beat Detroit at home, and they should have beat Detroit on the road. That kind of gives me some encouragement going into the offseason, thinking, okay, you're a reachable, you're an attainable improvement away from going in and competing in your division. How do you feel about the way the Bears ended things?
I think it's tough. I hated the way that last game went. I hated the way it was called. I thought Justin looked really uncomfortable that whole game. I thought, you know, I think a lot of us thought like he was going to come out and be wildly aggressive, right? There's nothing to lose. We don't have a playoff spot to lose. Like, just let him go out there. Let him rip it. Let's be super aggressive with the defense and let's just go after Green Bay. And it felt like they played a game where they were trying not to lose. And then when you watch the contrast of Jordan Love to Justin Fields, I think that's where it felt really scary to me. Because you're watching this guy who looks real comfortable in the pocket, is making quick decisions, making quick throws, not holding on to the ball too long. And you're watching Justin, you know, getting crushed over there. So it's just like, that's the part that scares me. It doesn't feel super far away, but I'm just worried the part where it is far away might be Justin.
Dang, Jeff, this is not just some chef. This guy knows football. So
I love it.
I'm not gonna ask your answer. Do you have a specific opinion about the quarterback position? And I don't, you know, I guess you can give me an explanation, but you know, it's one of the biggest topics in the NFL football world outside the head coaching consideration of the rest of the league.
I think it's tough. You know, we're number one pick 2 years in a row. So you're either going to say we're going to trade the number one pick 2 years in a row and we're going to go all in on Justin again, or are you going to say, hey, we see what the competition is. We know what we have, and we're going to take a gamble that maybe there's something better out there. And I think that's kind of the two roads right now, right? Because I think it's like we have the cap space, we have the picks, where we're going to be, whoever it is, you're going to be able to build around them. You know what I mean? Whether it's there's a heavy wide receiver drafted that first round, the wide receivers going into free agency this year are nuts. You know what I mean? So right. I think it's like being able to pick somebody up, you know, it's like, I think I have a sick fantasy where it's like Mike Evans and DJ Moore out there. And it's like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, and it's just like, who cares who throws to him at that point? Right. You know what I mean? Just get the ball up in the air. Somebody will bring it down. But it's hard, you know, they keep saying consistency, but I have a hard time believing if you're the GM, you know, this season, you know, is a huge season for you where you look at that number one pick and you say you're going to trade it away and not say, hey, like maybe, you know, one of these kids out there is what they are supposed to be.
When did it kind of crystallize for you that you were a Bear?
I mean, it, you know, listen, I was born 4 months after the Bears won the Super Bowl. So, you know what I mean? I've never seen a Bears Super Bowl in my lifetime. My dad's a Bears fan. I'm a Bears fan. I grew up in a house, you know, he had all the posters on the wall of the weight room that were, you know, the Black and Blues brothers and the Junkyard Dogs. It was instant. You know what I mean? There was no other option. My dad's a Cubs fan. I'm a Sox fan. We agree on almost nothing, but there was always the Bears. That was always a day one thing of just, you know what I mean? Like Sundays watching the Bears. And it's just, it's been forever. I always loved the big guys growing up. You know what I mean? I was a, you know, big guy. I was a lineman. So it's like, I loved Olin Krutz. He was always one of my favorites. I loved the way he played. He was mean. You know what I mean? He just seemed like a real son of a bitch out there. And I like loved that. The guy who, if he was like on anyone else's team, you'd probably hate him. I'm of the Urlacher era. So like getting to watch like Urlacher play, you just, you know, for me, I was like, oh yeah, we just have the greatest middle linebackers always forever, you know, and it was just unbelievable to watch. And I think him and Devin Hester might have been two of the most exciting guys I've ever seen wear a Bears uniform in my lifetime, at least.
Did you go to any Bears games? Because I remember the first time I went to a Bears game, and it was a Bears-Packers preseason game. And it was on my birthday back in probably the early 70s.
Yeah, I mean, we didn't go to a lot of Bears games, you know, because Bears games were expensive. They were hard to get into. And so it was, I remember the first time I went to Soldier Field was actually my dad took me, you know, this is like some real South Side. So my dad's brother, of course, is a priest. So my dad's brother is a priest and he's a missionary priest. So he was in town for like a week. And so it was Notre Dame was playing at Soldier Field. So we went down to Soldier Field, scalped tickets late to get in, sat like 12th row behind Lou Holtz when Rick Meyer was the quarterback. And that was the first time I was ever inside Soldier Field.
I was at that game on the sidelines. And I think that's the one that Rick Meyer had a really good day, and Beano Cook said, Rick Meyer is going to be a 4-year All-American and a Heisman Trophy winner at the end of the day. They might have been playing Northwestern or something.
I remember it was like Rick Meyer, and I was like, man, this guy is awesome. If the Bears could get this guy, this would be the guy. This would solve all our problems. Well, obviously, I wasn't right on that.
Who have you met in terms of sports personalities over the course of your career as a chef?
You know, the first real nice restaurant I worked at was Table 52, the Gold Coast. And we used to do, it was like a fine dining Southern restaurant. And on Sundays, we would do fried chicken. It was the only day of the week we did like these fried chicken dinners with mashed potatoes. And it was like $42 fried chicken. It was ridiculous, right? But it was like Tommy Harris was on the Bears then. And like that. So this was the 07, 08 era. And these guys would come in and everybody would be really dressed up in this restaurant. These guys would roll in after a Sunday game wearing flip-flops and gym shorts, you know, being the size of the doorway and come just crush. And I was like, this is the best. Like, this is just really, really cool. At that same place, Eli Manning ate there one time. And it was one of those crazy things. And I think like growing up, you know, you see these quarterbacks out there and you see all these huge guys around them. And then you see these quarterbacks in real life. And that's always the thing that shocked me is like how just monster these guys are. You know what I mean? The first time I saw like Brett Favre, I was like, oh, this dude's like huge. Like this dude's not like, you know what I mean? You're like, oh, why can't they tackle this guy? It's like, well, because he's 6'3", 225. And you know what I mean? You know, I mean, for me being from Chicago, one of my biggest ones was Jordan. I got to cook for Jordan a couple times, LeBron. But one of my favorite people, honestly, I worked at a place and Ozzie Guillen used to come in all the time. and he would sit at the chef's counter, and I was just a cook at the time, and he would, I mean, he'd have us going all night. Like, he would just tell stories. Like, he would tell stories about, like, him and Joey Cora in the minor leagues in, like, you know, border Texas towns, like, getting in fist fights at, like, honky-tonks because, like, you know, Joey Cora was, like, all the ladies at the bar were talking to Joey Cora. And he would just, like, get in a fight with, like, six ragnut dudes. And he's like, Joey Cora would just beat the shit out of all of them. He's like, he's the toughest guy you've ever met. So it was like, that was one of my favorite. He would just tell stories forever.
Before you became famous and won Top Chef, did you ever have a favorite restaurant in your life before, you know, you had everything thrust upon you that you've had?
Yeah, I mean, I had a couple. You know, there's one in the West Loop called the Vec. Was always one of my favorites. That was mine and my wife's first date. So that one was always, you know, really special one to me. Lula Cafe up in Logan Square. Just, yep. You know, an absolute gem. And I mean, for me, like the real, like, you know, the OG spot for me, I grew up, like 84th and St. Louis. I grew up in Ashburn. So it's like, I grew up two blocks away from Vito and Nick's. So it's like, that for me is like, you know, home.
Preparation for football, whether you're a player or you're a broadcaster, you spend a lot of time watching tape and, kind of you become familiar with your opponent and what they do well and what they don't do well. When you go into a restaurant before you, you know, ran a business of your own, were you always taking mental notes about serving preparation, taste, or delivery, and the kind of same things that I would be paying attention to watching football?
For sure, especially when I traveled, you know what I mean? Especially if I went, like, if I went over to Italy or if I went to Croatia, I would bring, you know, a notebook with me, and I wouldn't bring it to dinner, but at the end of the night, I'd go home and I'd write, you know what I mean? I'd be like, okay, you know, went to this cafe this morning. I like the way they serve their espresso with a little sparkling water and they put it on a tray. And that was really nice. And like, I noticed this little thing, or like I had this dish and I liked this about it, didn't like this about it, but I think it's a good idea. Like, you know, come back to it. And just kind of like track what was happening. So I could go back and look at it. And I still, you know, and even now with kind of the chefs I have under me, when they go out, you know, or if they go on a trip and they come back, I'm like, okay, what did you eat? Where did you eat? Oh, you ate at this place. What did you like about it? What did you see there that was really good? You know, what did you see there that was kind of strange to you? You know what I mean? What service thing did you think was a nice touch? And just like, cause so we're always kind of the same way for you guys. You know, you're always having football conversations, right? You're always thinking about, you know, how do we improve? It's the same idea where it's like, I want, you know, I'm always thinking about it. And even if I'm in a restaurant, I can kind of turn it off and be like, okay, these aren't my problems, but it doesn't mean I can't not see it. You know what I mean? Like if I can hear your ticket printer, I can hear that ticket printer going off and I'm looking around the room and I'm like, okay, this is shit's about to hit the fan in this room. Like, you know what I mean? I'm counting the servers on the floor. I'm looking back at the kitchen. You're down a line cook. You have 11 tickets on the board. You got two guys cranking it out. You got two servers, both working 11 table sections. Like, this is about to be, we're going to be here for another hour and a half waiting for stuff.
You're like a coach. You're like a coach.
Yeah.
Did you ever have the occasion to go to Thayer Brothers Restaurant in Joliet?
No.
No, I have, you know, it's funny. I worked at a bar out on the line of like where Joliet hits Mokena, hits New Lenox. It was like Schoolhouse Road in 20, maybe. Those intersect out there, I think it is. Like Lincoln Highway 20. My buddy's dad opened this bar and he just, you know, he hired me. I was like 19. And he's like, yeah, you're just going to do all this stuff. And I was like, yeah, sure. I love it. You know what I mean? And I laid tile. I dug out the beer garden, changed kegs, whatever he needed. And it is like, you know, people don't know about those south suburbs. It's a whole nother world out there. It is just like, it blew my mind. It's wild. It's such a mix of people out there. It was fun as hell. But it was a wild time.
My mom and my brother, it's a every single day job. You know, there is, I always tell people, there's no you're over the hump or everything's downhill from here, because you're putting together a group and a team of people just like a head coach would bring a coaching staff and a team together. So I just think that the effort and the work that goes into the everyday operation of a restaurant, sometimes people don't realize it when they open the door and they get great fried chicken for whatever the price is.
Right. And it's, you know, it's one of those things I always tell, you know, when people are like, oh, I, you know, a friend, they're thinking about getting into it or whatever, you know, I always tell them, and I'm real straightforward about it. Like, I'm not trying to talk anybody in this industry. I'm not trying to talk them out, but it's like, I just try to be honest about it. I'm like, it's not a great job. It's a really hard job. It can be a very thankless job. I'm like, if you can wake up tomorrow and you can imagine doing anything else, go do that. It's a better job. I go, I love this. I don't want to wake up tomorrow and do anything else. I cannot fathom it. You know, I go, so it's a great career for me because I love it, but it's not a great job. So if it's just something where you're like, oh, I think I kind of want to do this, it's like, man, do anything else.
Oh, one thing just to analogize that is when the latest version of the Star is Born movie was made between Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga, Bradley Cooper went to Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam and asked him about, how do you become a musician to play this role? And Eddie Vedder says, don't do it because you're not going to be good at it. It's too difficult of a role of playing the guitar and singing. You know, you run that fine line. You don't want to discourage people, but if someone has their mindset to go and take that task on, they just have to realize from a Top Chef how difficult of a day-to-day operation it is.
And I think, you know, you guys do something at a super high level. You know what I mean? Tom, you played at the highest level, and it's like the amount of, you know, like sacrifice that goes into it. There's no real shortcuts for that. You know what I mean? There's some people who are wildly natural talented in all things. Right. But it's still, it's like, usually those people are also like some of the hardest working people in the room. And so I think it's just one of those things where it's like, yeah, you can do this. There's nothing wildly special about me, but it's just, it's a hell of a lot of sacrifice and hard work.
Oh, yeah. You guys put on some unbelievable displays of creativity and passion. And I'm sitting there at Rosemary, which is one of my favorite places ever to go. And I'm sitting there at the counter on a couple of occasions just watching, you know, for an offensive lineman, it's elephants on parade, right? Everything is like in synchronicity and these big guys are just moving. That's the way the kitchen is. And that's not easy. Everything's happening at once. It's nonstop. And that's the same way to call a game. It's you're dialed in. It's nonstop.
Right. And I think people, you know, look at it, they see, you know, they see where you are, not where you came from, right? So it's easy to say like, oh yeah, you know, you guys just show up and call a Bears game, right? That's just, you know what I mean? You just decided it one day.
Hey.
Like you saw that ad on Craigslist and you said, yeah, I'll throw my hat in the ring, you know? you know, just a couple of guys called plays. And it's like, I think, you know, it's the same thing. Even, you know, it's like, as much as like, especially now, it's like they can Google any of us and they can figure out, you know, our whole career trajectory, yes, what we've done, where we've worked, what all of it that goes into it. And people, you know, they still walk in the restaurant every day and they're like, oh, so did you cook before this?
It's oh, like, my God, Joe. It's like, Joe,
it's like, I haven't done anything else for the past 20 years.
Joe,
I don't have any other skills whatsoever.
Hand to God, this happened more than we care to admit. Tom and Jeff, are you guys going to be at the game on Sunday? Oh, yeah, it happened. I mean, I'm not That's joking. Awesome. Yeah, that
like,
happens.
Yeah, I don't know. We might call it. We might not. You know what I mean? We might just watch this one out in the garage at Thayer's house and, you know, have a couple pops.
Unbelievable. This is the Bears Etc. podcast, episode 51. Game day snacking calls for Good Foods chunky guacamole made with Haas avocados, tomatoes, onion, cilantro, and a squeeze of lime juice. It's the perfect snack to watch while the Bears win. Score some today at your local grocery store. Game day is guac day. And our special guest on episode 51, Joe Flam. Joe, what got you started?
I got started in this industry when I was 15, 16 years old. And I just, you know, I needed a job. Like anybody else, high school kid needed a job. I was a busboy at this place my sister worked at. And then my buddy, his dad ran a place out in Palos Heights. He was like, hey, when you turn 16 and you can drive, I can get you a job there. And it was a little better job, but I didn't have to work with my older sister. So that was appealing as well. For me, it was instant. I fell in love with restaurants first. I was like, this is the best. Like, it was the place where I felt like home. Like, I had found my people. I had found, you know, a place where I felt really comfortable. I started really coming out of my shell. And, you know, I loved everything about it. I loved the late nights. I loved the hard work. I loved, you know, meeting people and talking to people and just the chaos of it all. You know, it was completely insane. You know, I didn't know any chefs. This place was like a neighborhood bar and grill. So it was like, you know what I mean? There were dudes who worked in the kitchen who were like, we had guys who were there 6 months a year. They would go back to Mexico. The other crew would come through for 6 months a year. And like, that's how that kitchen ran there. and they just rotated them in and out. Like, it wasn't, you know, chefs, it wasn't white hats, it wasn't anything like that. But it made me, you know, fall in love with it. And so my plan at the time was, you know, the guy who owned the place was a lawyer. So I was like, all right, well, if you want to open a restaurant, you got to go be a lawyer and make a bunch of money, and then you could, you know, buy a restaurant when you're 50. So that was my plan. I was going to, you know, go to school for, you know, accounting, get my degree, go to law school, become a lawyer, try to make a bunch of money, and try to buy a bar and grill when I was 50.
Your timeline was elevated significantly.
Yeah, so I was about 2.5 years into an accounting degree, and I decided, you know, I had spent about 7 months cooking for this place, and I just, like, really then fell in love with the cooking aspect of it. I had grown up cooking. I always loved food, but I'd never done it professionally. In this place, you know, it was kind of one of those where they were like, oh, hey, we need somebody to work a pizza station. Do you know how to do that? And I was like, yeah, I know how to do that, not knowing how to do that at all, and just kind of, you know, fake it till I made it. So I spent about 7 months there. And, you know, I'd left to work in an office, and because I was like, yeah, I need to start to get, you know, my real career going. And all I could think about was cooking. I was like, man, that was the best. So I literally one day I just Googled. I was like, how did Emeril Lagasse become a chef? And so I was like, oh, he went to culinary school. I was like, what's culinary school? So then I found a culinary school. And then so about 2 months later, I was like, you know what? I'm going to drop out of college and I'm going to go to culinary school. So I dropped out of college and just went all in on it. I, you know, moved back to my parents' house and on the south side, lived in the basement, and just was like, all I did for, you know, culinary school is like 15 months. It's not, you know, like real college. And I started there. A week later, I started at Table 52. And, you know, 5 days a week, I went to school from 8 to 4. 6 days a week, I went to the restaurant. You know, I'd go straight from school to the restaurant. I'd work doubles on the weekends. And, you know, that was my first year and a half as a cook. It was just like all I did was, you know, cook. Like, it just, you know, I was terrible. I was, you know, I just was burnt everywhere. I used to carry super glue in all my pockets so that I could glue pieces of me back together when I cut myself so many times. Wow. And just kept coming back. And I was like, you know, I think I was so surprised they didn't fire me. And I think they were so surprised that I didn't quit that they just, you know, let me stay for 2 years, you know, until I finally figured out how to actually cook a little bit.
You know, Joe, there's a little restaurant in Olawalu, Maui, and it's called Leota's. And that's the name of the grandmother of the family that owns it. And they specialize in little pies and sandwiches. And when my mom taught me to cook, she would put all the ingredients in a bag and send me home with it, knowing that I would have to call her a couple times and it would increase the amount of times I talked to her. And Rosemary, that's the name of your grandmother. Is that true?
Yeah, so it's Rose was my dad's mom, my Irish grandmother, and then Mary is my mom's mom. And Mary's, you know, the idea was Rosemary because Rosemary, the herb, grows all along the Adriatic coast, right? Through Italy, through Croatia, and in both Italian and Croatian cultures, it's a sign of, you know, good luck and good fortune. So, like, when I got married, there was rosemary in all the vases on the tables. Like, it's kind of like an old school thing. But I thought it'd be cool as just kind of a nod to them to do it as the two words as, you know, Rose and Mary. And, you know, my grandma Mary is 94 now, but it's like we still, you know what I mean? Like for the holidays and stuff, we're still doing Feast of the Seven Fishes. We still make raviolis for Thanksgiving. And, you know, and she doesn't cook anymore. She's not like getting in the kitchen, but, you know, she's still like, she'll throw the apron on and then she'll kind of get her little, you know, seat and just like overwatching everything. And you know what I mean? And I got to tell her all the numbers and, you know, and then it's like harassing me about how much money I spent on fish and thinking I'm lying to her and not telling her enough. You know what I mean? She's 94, but it's like, you know, this year it's like the price of scallops went down. So she's like, well, how much were the scallops? I was like, well, they were like $225 for a gallon of them. She's like, well, they were $320 last year. Yeah, they were. But like, I didn't even remember that. But it's like, you know, I'm like, yeah, they were like, you know, that was last year. Like, you know, the market was tighter. And she's like, all right, well, you better not be lying to me.
Were they the influences in your cooking life, or is it something that, you know, you kind of took a road by yourself and then you developed into the chef that you've become?
I mean, a little bit of both. I think they were, you know, my grandma made me fall in love with traditions, you know, like coming from a big family. And I just saw, like, you know, it was such a cool thing of like having these cooking traditions. And I just assumed, you know, kind of everybody had these, you know what I mean? Everybody was doing their Christmas Eve with Feast of the Seven Fishes, making raviolis from scratch for Thanksgiving. And, you know, the older I got, the more special I realized all these things were. You know, that time I got with her where we're, you know, cleaning squid on newspapers in the mudroom, you know, like getting them ready. like how special and unique that was. And I loved, you know, even before I got into, you know, cooking professionally, like me and my grandma would cook all the holidays together because I just loved the tradition of it. I loved everybody getting together. And I just thought it was amazing. I never wanted those things to go away. And so that was kind of a big, you know, motivator for me. But as I got into the professional chef world, they were very much like, you know, like, what in the hell are you doing? Like, what, why are you dropping out of college to, like, you know, cook? Like, why don't you get a degree? Why don't you get a law degree? And then if you still want to, you know, go play chef, you can, you know what I mean? Go play chef. So it wasn't a lot of encouragement in the early years. It was a lot of, you know, Christmases and Thanksgiving where people were very excited that I was cooking, but also, you know, all my aunts and uncles being like, so, you know, when are we going to go back and finish that degree? You know what I mean? Like, what are you going to really do? Like, when are you going to stop, you know what I mean, messing around? And, you know, so it was probably about, you know, I think 7 or 8 years into my cooking career. And I think I was at my first sous chef job and I was working at Girl and the Goat and they were getting a lot of press and it was really big. I remember I was driving somewhere with my dad and he's like, so you're pretty serious about this cooking thing, huh? This is like what you're going to do. I was like, I've been doing this for 7 years, Dad. You know what I mean? Like, what do you think I was going to do? You know, like, I was like, yeah, man. He's like, oh, okay. Well, still think you should get a degree.
So was there a chip ever put on your shoulder by a fellow chef or somebody that had been established in this business said, young man, I don't know if you got it. You may want to think about something else, or are you just naturally gifted at it?
I'm definitely not naturally gifted at it. You know what I mean? I was definitely never the best cook in the kitchen, you know, and my best friend owns 3 restaurants in Detroit. And he was one of those guys where he is phenomenal athlete. He's just one of those people. If you teach him how to do anything, you know, he'll be better at it than you by the time you're done. And so it was just, he was my station partner. And so he was the push, you know what I mean? This dude set a ridiculous standard of like, this is how we work. So I was always playing catch up with him. And you know, I worked around a ton of really talented people and just kind of coming through it. Like, one, I had the thing in the back of my mind of everyone in my family telling me to go back to school. So I was like, I can't fail. There's no back on this. Like, I'm all in on this. This is the only road. Like, I am going. The one that really put a chip on my shoulder, though, was I remember I went and I, you know, I've been cooking for a while. I've been a sous chef 2 great places. And I went, I applied to be a sous chef at this Italian restaurant I really wanted to work at. I went through the process, did a tasting, go all the way down. Chef calls me in and I'm like, you know, I call my buddy on the way there. I'm like, hey, Joe, I'm like, I got, you know, chef called me in. I got this job. I'm like, this is awesome. I can't wait to work at this restaurant. Blah, blah, blah. I go in there, sit down and he goes, hey man, came down to you and another guy. He worked for us before. You never worked for us. He goes, so we went the other direction. So I end up taking a sous chef job at another Italian restaurant down the street. And so the second I stepped my foot in the door there, I was just like, it's go. Like, we are go. We are going to push hard. We are going to make sure, you know, I'm like, my time here is going to be, you know, spent the best way it can. And I ended up being, you know, taken over, you know, that was at Spiaggia. I ended up taking over Spiaggia as chef and, you know, being the chef there for 5 years and keeping a Michelin star for 5 years. We're the only Italian restaurant in Chicago ever to have a Michelin star. So it was like one of those where it was just kind of like, you know, we really, you know, it was like, fine. Like, you know what I mean? You guys don't want me. I'm going here and I'm going to show everybody I belong to be here.
Oh my God. It's just like an athlete. You had to turn in your cookbook. Tom had to turn in his playbook.
Yeah.
But you know, the thing also to analogize again, you know, you talk to your dad, you said, I've been in this for 7 years. This is going to be my career path. The average life expectancy of an NFL player is 2.3 years or maybe 2.2 years.
It's up to 3.1 now.
Okay. 3.1. Is there a realization? Can you recognize it early in their career of who has it and who doesn't?
Well, I think, you know, and I'm sure it's the same way, you know, you probably feel about looking at players where it's like, you know, when I was 22 and I was coming up and I was in a kitchen, I was like, oh, everyone around me is so talented. And this is, you know, we're all so amazing. Like, we're all going to be chefs in 10 years, right? All of us are going to have restaurants. And you kind of have that mindset, right? Like, we're all still going to be doing this in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. And the further I got down that road, the older I got, the more you realize how great the fall off is. And, you know, like how much of this is just about, you know, perseverance and sticking around and keeping and staying in the fight. And, you know, now being, you know, 20 years in, being older, having opened my own restaurant, having been a part of a lot of restaurant openings, now you have a lot more where it's like I can talk to a young cook or a young sous chef. You see those ones where you're like, there's that person special. Like they're gonna do things, right? And you can see that drive in them and that push in them. And you know, and then sometimes people surprise you. You know what I mean? There's always that. But it's, you know, I think it's like now it's a lot easier to have the realization of like, just because all these people are cooks doesn't mean they're all going to be chefs. And it doesn't mean they have to be either. You know, I mean, my path is not the only path. There's a lot of paths in this world. And it's not saying it's the best path either, but it's just, so what I try to do is just try to help them find their path, right? And be like, hey, you can go a lot of ways with this. I'm just trying to give you a set of skills that, you know what I mean, is hopefully going to give you a living that you really enjoy.
Hey, Joe, I never had a plan B either. It was NFL. Or I don't know what else. If you had a plan B, is there any time throughout the course of growing the success of your career you may have gone to plan B? Or was it like me where there was no other option?
Yeah, I mean, once I started cooking, I never had a plan B. The only time I think I really had to start thinking about it was I was like a stay-at-home dad during COVID for a year and a half because all the restaurants, you know, were closed and I was trying to open Rosemary. And so it was all this stuff. And I remember like, you know, I was running a lot and I was just like running through the woods one day. And I was like, well, what if just like restaurants never come back? Like, what am I going to do? My buddy had just got on as a like an FBI special agent. And I was like, how much work would I have to do to convince these guys that I could be a part of the FBI? I was like, no one would suspect me at least. So maybe I could talk them into, you know what I mean? Like,
right.
Like, you know what I mean? I was like, I think the best thing I got going for me is that, you know what I mean? I'm covered in tattoos and I look like an asshole. Don't look like a cop, but like, you know, I think I'd have to do a lot of work to get there, but that was kind of the plan B.
When it's time to tackle some game day deals, then go with a grocer who's been part of Chicago since 1899, Jewel Osco, the official grocery store of the Chicago Bears, here with Joe Flam, the unbelievable chef at multiple restaurants in his career, but right now, Rosemary. Do we call it Boulevard or do we call it by the initials?
Well, we call it Boulevard. It's okay. Written by the initials, but we call it Boulevard.
All right, we call it Boulevard. We got to hear about your experience on Top Chef and what that did for you and your publicity as a top chef in this world. What's it like? What's it really like? What are you at liberty to say what it's really like? And how did you capture that in Top Chef 15 in Colorado?
Yeah, so... you know, Top Chef is a wild one. It's I got on the show because they came to cast in Chicago. I didn't know they were casting in Chicago. I didn't go to the casting. I didn't try out. And I was working for Tony Montuano at the time. So they called Tony. They knew him from other stuff. And they said, hey, you're a chef. We're in Chicago. We're trying to cast season 15 of Top Chef. We met a bunch of people. We didn't like anybody. Do you know anybody we should meet? And he goes, yeah, I got this guy working for me. He goes, you gotta meet him. So I get a call a couple minutes later from Tony and he's, you know, I'm like, hey, chef. He's like, hey, the Top Chef producers are in town. They want to meet you. And I'm like, for what? And he's like, listen, you know, he's like, take a meeting. And I was like, all right, fine, Tom.
And Tony's at Spiaggia.
This is, you know, Tony's the OG, you know what I mean? Founder of Spiaggia. So, you know what I mean? It's like, dude, he's my mentor. He's one of my best friends. So Tony says, take a meeting. I take a meeting. So I'm like, all right, cool. Send him over. They come over, I talk to these people for, you know, 40 minutes. And this lady's like, and I'm like, they don't want me on this show. Like, they don't. Like, I'm like, I'm not interested. I'm like a regular, just Southside, you know, Chicago-ass person. Like, you know what I mean? I'm like every other dude I grew up with. Like, and I was like, they're not going to be interested in this. So I talked to them for 40 minutes, and this lady's like, you got to do this. She's like, it's a long road, but you got to do it. And I was like, all right, I'll try. And so I was like, I'm not going to make it on the show. So we go down this path, we do all these things, you know, you have to do interviews and you send them menus and videos and all this stuff. It takes months. I got to do a psych exam. I do a physical exam, all these things. So finally, it's like April 19th, I get a call. They're like, hey, this is Top Chef. You're on season 15. You need to be in Colorado May 5th. You got 2.5 weeks to prepare. You can't tell anyone where you're going. So I have to come up with a cover story. So I come up with a cover story that I'm going to work at Tony's other restaurant in Florida for 2 months because they need help down there. So I told like him, I tell my wife, I told my parents, but I can't tell my crew. I can't tell, you know what I mean, my friends. I, you know, my brother was in high school at the time. So I was like, I didn't tell him. I didn't tell any of my siblings. I was just like, yeah, I'm going to work at this restaurant down in Florida, whatever. And then when you get there, day one, they throw you in a hotel room. They lock you in there. And they come on the first night. And then they go through all your stuff. And they take all your stuff. So they take your phone, your keys, your wallet, everything. And you don't get any of that back till you're done filming 2 months later.
Wait, what? Why?
Yeah. So they don't. Why? Because they don't want. Because you aren't allowed to have any access to recipes. So whatever you know, you know. You can't like Google a recipe real quick and be like, "How do I make this cake?" or whatever. So you have, you know, no internet access. They don't want you to have contact with the outside world because you have to sign a $1 million NDA before you go. To, they don't want you to be able to like text and be like, oh, I lost. They don't want you taking pictures of what's going on while you're there. You basically, how it works is then every like 3 to 5 days, you'd get a phone call and it'd be 10 minutes on camera, on speakerphone, on a producer's phone. And you can't say anything.
Wow, so, this is stunning. Tom, did you have any idea this was the case?
No.
Oh my God, no. This is fascinating. Keep going.
Yes.
You know, you'd get a phone call every once in a while, but they wanted you just dialed into the pressure. So it was like there was no TV, there was no books, there was no magazines, nothing. All you did was you film and cook and do interviews. And so you went every day for 2 months. And if you went out the first day, you were there for 2 months. If you went to the final like I did, you were there for 2 months. So no matter what, you signed a 2 month commitment. And your whole life outside of that just went on pause. So you just disappear for 2 months.
Even if you lost.
Even if you lost. So then they'd send you to like a hotel, like way out in the burbs away from where we were filming. And then you got a bunch of chefs. Cause I got kicked off for a minute. Right. So I got kicked off for a minute. So I get sent to the other hotel. And so now you got 10 chefs in a hotel who can't work, have no phones, nothing, whatever. We just have, they're giving us cash every day. We have nothing to do, a limited time. So it's just like, it's like spring break. Like, it's just like complete insanity. You know what
it's
I mean?
Like it's like training camp.
Yeah.
It's like you like walk in and you're just like, I walked in the first day and I walk up and there's somebody had taken a window off of the, like one of the rooms so that you could walk into the room from the pool area so that you didn't have to walk around to the door. So they just popped the window off of the wall so that we could walk through there and just, you know what I mean? They were making drinks in there and you go back outside and everybody's partying. And it was just like, it was an absolute just insanity. So that's like where everybody else was. So then it was like, I finally made it back on the show. And it was just, it was insane. You know what I mean? It was like, you woke up every day. You had no idea what time you're going to wake up. You had no idea what you were doing. So it's just like, you woke up every day to cameras. Or it's just like somebody would knock at the door. You'd open the door and there'd be four cameras there. And you'd be like, all right, I guess we're rolling.
It's Hard Knocks, right? It's Hard Knocks.
And then it was a go. And you'd get in the car and we'd be like, where are we going today? And they're like, can't tell you. So you never knew what was going on and you just, you know what I mean? It was like literal, you know, we used to call it emotional terrorism. Like it was just, you know, like anytime something happened, you just became so suspicious because you're like, you'd like wake up and like something would be moved in the kitchen. And you'd be like, oh no, something weird is going to happen. Like they're going to make us cook in here. Or you know what I mean? Like something, you know, it's like if something was off, you're like, oh no, this is like part of something. You know what I mean? Everything was part of something. It was all like a setup. Some crazy challenge. So it was just like, it was nuts, you know? And so you go, you do this thing 2 months, right? I go, I win. I'm like, yes. But then it's like, you get back and nobody knows you won. Nobody even knows you were there. And you know, it was kind of funny. Cause it's like in real life, I won Top Chef on a Tuesday night at midnight on top of a mountain in Aspen. And then they took me off of there. They brought me to interview. And then they take you back to the hotel and that's it. You know what I mean? And it's like, you can't go party with anyone. You can't go out. You're still under lock and key. I still don't have a phone. You know what I mean? I called my wife at 2 a.m. on a Tuesday to tell her I won. And so then I get back and it's like, oh, you know, you can't tell anybody because you're under all these NDAs. From the time I got back, like end of June in 2017, and the finale aired March 8th of 2018.
After it was all said and done, are you glad you made the decision to go? Or if you knew all that stuff going in, would it made it harder for you to commit to it?
I think it was one of those things where it's like you're almost better not knowing. I think it would have been harder because they kind of lie to you. You know what I mean? They're like, oh, yeah, you're going to make a phone call. You're going to do some emails. Yeah, don't worry about it. Like, we got you. You know, like, and then you get there. They're like, yeah, you're not making a phone call for 5 days. And you're like, can somebody, like, text my wife and tell her I'm alive? It's like, I got on a plane 2 days ago.
Oh, my God.
And, like, you know what I mean? So it was kind of good not knowing all of it. And, I mean, for me, it's like, you know, I was so happy I did it. Obviously, I won. So that's, you know, like, one of the people who was on the show with me, it's like somebody asked me, they go, are you happy you did it? They're like, you won. Of course he's happy he did it. You know what I mean? Like, and, but I, even if I didn't, I would have been happy I did it. It was such a unique experience. You know, we got to travel some really cool places. I made some amazing friends. And I mean, it's just, you know, it's one of those things. It's like, it's beyond my wildest dreams.
So every year of my Bear career, I would go to training camp at University of Wisconsin-Platteville, which kind of in the middle of nowhere. We didn't have cell phones at that time. You didn't have a lot of time to communicate. The sense of accomplishment I had when I was driving home after Platteville was over and I retained my position, I stayed healthy, I knew that I was driving back to my house in a starter's role. It was such a sense of relief that it kind of overtook you at times. It had to be similar to that in kind of the same sense, because you're isolated, you're not talking to anybody, and then the sense of accomplishment that you feel when it's all said and done, it's going to do incredible things for your career, just like it did for my career.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was, I remember, like, so the finale finishes, right? And it was like, we were literally on top of a mountain, so they had to get me to the bottom, and they were going to stop running the gondola soon. So it's like, if you watch the finale, you like see that last second of me like toasting champagne, and literally I am in that room for about 4 more seconds. And then they run me into a gondola, and the gondola at Aspen is about a half hour gondola ride down.
Right.
So then it's just me and this woman, Maria, who is my handler. Two of us are now sitting in a gondola in the pitch dark going down a mountain.
This is just nuts. This is nuts.
And so, and I'm like, I just won Top Chef. And I'm just like sitting there, and I'm like sitting there like this. And she just looks at me. She's like, do you want to like yell or something? I'm like, yeah. And she like opens all the windows on the gondola, and I'm like, ah! You know, and like screaming. And like, so it was like crazy. And then it was like, you know, like you said, Tom, like coming home, it's like, you know, I'm sitting on the plane, like just like blinking, like, did this happen?
Wow.
Like, is this real? You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, and now I'm just like, and it's like, I get on the plane, I go back, and then it's like, you know, it's whatever, it's Sunday. So I get home, and then it's like, I go to work on Tuesday, and I got to act like
nothing ever happened.
I was just gone for 2 months. Hey, don't worry about it. And, you know, it was just, it was such an insane ride. And then, you know, when the season started airing, it just blew up, and it was so fun, and just, you know, Chicago's so cool. It's such a homer city, right? We go so hard. Yep. We go so hard, and I just love it. And it just, you felt that, you know what I mean, so much when I was on the show, just like everybody, you know what I mean? Like the city was pulling for me, and it was so cool. And it was, you know, I think I told Jeff this story once, but I had, you know, my Friday Night Lights moment. I was like, you know, we were down to the bottom three, and I was like at a Whole Foods, and I was walking out of Whole Foods, and I was like paying. And this guy, you know, and I was like, I just got finished paying. This guy's like, he's like, hey, Joe, we're all rooting for you. And I was like, oh, thanks. And everybody's like, ah, and started going nuts. And it was like so cool. Oh, and I was like, this is just bonkers, man. That's just awesome. So wild. It was so fun.
Vizzy Hard Seltzer, the official hard seltzer of the Chicago Bears here on the Bears Etc. podcast. So you made a fish dish in your first quick fire on the show. Would you have made that again?
Yeah, I think so. That one worked out really well. So I would run that one back. It was a red snapper. I cooked in the wood-fired oven with fennel, I think caracara orange segments, and maybe olives. I can't remember if I did that too. Maybe a little bit of fennel pollen.
Best dish you ever made on Top Chef? And has it or is it on any of your menus at your restaurants?
The best dish I ever made on Top Chef was probably, I did this pasta in the finale that was like, it was a grano arso flour, so a burnt wheat flour, and I made this farce for it that was like a truffle pig head farce, and then made a brodo for it, so it was like a tortellini and brodo, but they came out like just stunning. Like they were just like, they had this like river rock looking like quality to it, and they were unbelievable. And that's probably, you know, what won me the finale. but it's not on a menu. It took 2 days to make 12 of them.
Really?
You know, so it was like, you know, it doesn't really work as like a practical dish. It was like, okay, this is, you know what I mean? One of those things where it's like, this can't be a real play in the playbook, but like, you know what I mean? Like if we down six and 2 seconds to go, we can huck this one.
Tell us about the Bear Den.
So that was funny. So, you know, me, Tyler, and Bruce, they just started calling us the Bear Den because they put you in these rooms. They don't tell you you're sharing rooms. And then all of a sudden, it's like I got three roommates and we're sleeping on IKEA bunk beds that were made for someone much not of my stature. And so that was, you know, just kind of a fun, you know, we were all grouped up together and we just had a lot of fun with that.
Do you like the national attention?
Yeah, I think it's fun. You know what I mean? It's like, and I think it's also, you know, I was telling somebody this, like, oh, is it weird, you know, if like people know you? And it's like, well, I mean, I grew up on the South Side. Like everybody knows everybody. You know what I mean? It's just kind of the way it is. So it doesn't feel weird. It's just like, oh, okay, I just meet more people. You know what I mean? It never feels to me like, oh, you're like famous. It's like, I don't think so. I think a few more people know who I am. And like, you know, those shows are fun, but it's like, for me, it's like, The love is restaurants. You know what I mean? That's my thing over everything. So to be able to use those to put our restaurants out there and meet people and network, like that's a blast. Like it's cool. You know what I mean? I've had people in the restaurant because of that, or, you know, been able to do things that I just, you know, never even dreamed of.
Who's your Super Bowl pick at this time?
I think the Ravens look really scary. I think they look really, really good. I feel like it's going to be Ravens Niners, and I think the Ravens are just going to be too much. They just look really complete this year. And I love Roquan. You know what I mean? He used to come into the restaurant all the time, so I'd love to see it for him. He's a great guy. I don't know. I feel like they're going to be hard to beat.
Show like Top Shelf, is there a home field advantage? Do you become so familiar with the kitchen and the pantry and everything that you can do everything as opposed to a neutral site that a Super Bowl will have?
Well, it's like always cooking in a neutral site, right? So nobody has the home field advantage because it's like, and the kitchen changes so much. And so, and it's like, and we're in Colorado, so we're dealing with, you know, elements. Like we're cooking at, you know, altitude. We're flatlanders over here, right? That's not what we do. And so it's completely different ballgame doing that. You know, we cooked at one restaurant that was 14,000 feet. And when you're at 14,000 feet, you know what I mean? Like, you know, the difference of playing in Chicago versus playing in Denver, right? So it's like that feeling of it. So, and it's like multiply that by three and then cook. And so, you know, when you get to those altitudes, like, you know, they talk about like water boils at a lower temperature, right? So you could, you know, and before I was on the show, I didn't really get how that affected things. But realizing that, like, yeah, water's going to boil at 187 at 14,000 feet or whatever it is. The problem is, it's like that water's not hot. You could sit in it.
Huh.
So it's like when you're cooking pasta, it's like this water isn't really boiling. It's just evaporating. So it's like to try to get water hot enough before it evaporated to like properly cook pasta or blanch vegetables or do anything was like a total nightmare. And it's like, there's no way to prepare for that unless you've ever cooked at altitude. So it was like, there was one chef there who, she was from Colorado, you know, she had worked at some higher elevation places. So she had a little bit home field on that, but still it was like, you know, the place we were cooking at was such high elevation. Like nobody had ever done it.
Have you ever done any private cooking for celebrities or politicians, whatever the case may be?
I've cooked for four presidents, which is pretty crazy.
Wow.
So I've cooked for H.W. Bush. I've cooked for W. I've cooked for Obama, and I've cooked for Biden.
No kidding.
Biden before he was president. I did the last, one of the coolest ones we did was a luncheon at the State Department. And it was the last State Department luncheon for the Obama Biden administration. For Renzi, who was the prime minister of Italy at the time. So they brought Tony Montuano in, because Spiaggia was Renzi's favorite Italian restaurant in Chicago. It was Barack's favorite Italian restaurant in Chicago. So they brought us in to do the luncheon. You know what I mean? Like plating your food on official State Department China is a pretty wild feeling.
Wow.
Like one of my favorite pictures ever is there's a picture of me and I'm standing in the hallway at the State Department. And I'm plating like 150 plates for lunch. And it's like me. And then there is like probably 10 people behind me, and it's like this police, that police, Secret Service, like FBI, like, you know what I mean? Just like there's nothing but like 11 people behind me with different badges and guns, like watching me plate like this really delicate little, you know, like roasted squash dish that I made. And it was just like, it's hysterical.
You probably could have talked shop. Your mom, if I'm not mistaken, is she still a lieutenant in the Chicago Police Department?
Yeah, my mom's been retired a few years now, but yeah, she was 30 years on the job. Wow. She was a lieutenant on the South Side.
Sounds like she would have been pretty tough. Pretty tough.
Yeah. She still got it.
Well, Joe, we could continue talking forever, but I just want to thank you for all your time. I know your time is valuable. We love that you're a Bears fan. We love the fact that it's ingrained in your blood, and we love what you prepare at Rosemary. I'm a big fan of the gnocchi Tommy with the beef cheek. Love the risotto. Different kinds of risotto and the Croatia. Is it lapinja bread?
Yeah.
Bread is insane. I don't know how that's that really happens, but that's fantastic. It's insane. You can't get enough of it. That's for sure.
Well, I've always been, you know, really big fans of you guys. And, you know, like I've been listening to Bears games on the radio since I can remember. And, you know, from when the radio, the TV used to time up a little bit better and we'd have it going on the radio with the TV on. Or if my dad would get so mad at the Bears at halftime, he'd just, you know, be like, all right, we're going out to the garage. And he'd put the game on the radio. Because for some reason, it's less frustrating, but more frustrating listening to the game on the radio. And, you know, the amount of times where it's like working Sundays coming through where it's like we'd have the Bears game going in some prep kitchen basement, you know what I mean, on Randolph or the Gold Coast, you know, just screaming, you know what I mean, at the radio with you guys. So it's really cool to be on this. And, you know, the first time you came in, Jeff, my old chef de cuisine, he's like, you think we could just get him to say, you know, Devin Hester, he's unbelievable, you know?
No. It's Devin Hester. You are ridiculous. Yeah, that's what you got to do.
Yeah. That was the call he wanted. He's like, you think he'd just stand on the counter and yell it once for us? And I was like, maybe wait till the second time he comes in, we can get him to do it.
Right. Hey, I'll do it. You give a couple drinks in me, I'll do it for sure.
Yeah. There we go.
We got to get Tommy over there as well. Again, we're brought to you by Miller Lite, the official beer of the Chicago Bears. Tastes like Miller Time Chicago. Joe, continued success. Best to you and your family, and have a great year, buddy.
Guys, absolute blast. Thanks for having me on.
Awesome thrill. So thank you so much for your time.
Oh, no, this was really cool, guys.
Tommy, how much fun was that? I mean, you know, we could talk to that guy about all things. He knows his sports, but there's not enough time to talk about a career like that. He is literally a top chef, and not just because of the show.
You think of the highest accomplished athlete that we've ever been able to talk to throughout our career. He is that in the food field.
Yep.
And it's amazing because I think we've only scratched the surface of how we could keep going. Talking about the Bears, talking about the draft, talking about other football teams. But there's 1,000 questions in cooking that I would love to be able to sit here and ask him. The versatility of his ability is which impressed me most, because we asked him a football question and he went for 10 minutes. And every single thing he said about his football knowledge was right on. And so that's the first thing. Oh, my God, that's impressive.
Game day snacking calls for good foods. Chunky guacamole made with Hass avocados, tomatoes, onions, cilantro, and a squeeze of lime juice. It's the perfect snack to watch while the Bears win. Score some today at your local grocery store. Game day is guac day. All right, let's wrap things up as we look at the Bears are looking at some coordinators. Obviously, they need to find one. And reportedly, the interviews include San Francisco passing game coordinator Clint Kubiak, the son of Gary Kubiak. He was an offensive coordinator in Minnesota. Denver's quarterback coach Russell Wilson. Greg Roman, the former Baltimore offensive coordinator developing Lamar Jackson, who won an MVP with Roman. Kentucky offensive coordinator Liam Cohen, who has ties to the Rams, where he was with that football team over there, and that coach, and Shane Waldron, the Seattle offensive coordinator. Greg Olson, our old pal, the former Bears quarterback coach in 03, who's had several stops. Detroit, the Rams, Tampa, Oakland, Jacksonville, Vegas. So a lot of experience, some young. There's a nice blend of options here. I'm not aware of any others that they have talked to or will do. I don't know what the timeline is. But again, these are all reportedly. It's a lot from that Shanahan tree, Tom. That Shanahan tree is very much a part of this.
You know, Jeff, we could talk to about 100 different names in consideration for the offensive coordinator position. But to me, the decision on quarterback is equally as important as the quarter as the offensive coordinator, because you have to get the evaluation of the new offensive coordinator as he looks at and studies what the Bears have done in the past, how his philosophical thinking of quarterback offense development fits into how the quarterback position is developing. So this is not just a one and done decision. This is a big impact decision, how it affects the offensive line, it affects the offense, it affects the receiver position, and it affects the quarterback position the most. So I think there's a lot of thinking that goes into every one of these candidates.
Do you feel a sense of optimism versus a sense of dread? Like, oh God, we got a big hill to climb.
I feel more optimism after watching the first round of the playoffs than I did before the playoff game started. Because when I look at what Green Bay went into Dallas and did to them, and how, touch and go it was for the last game of the year with the Green Bay Packers and the Bears, I think about what they did to Detroit at home and how they should have beat Detroit on the road. I think that the Bears are so close to a competitive division opportunity that getting the decisions right going forward plays in a huge role in the future success of the Bears. I would do nothing but talk confidently to my team in the process of the offseason, through OTAs, how close we are, how we have to take that next step, no matter who's here or who isn't here. And so I think the message going forward isn't, how are we going to come out of training camp? No, it's coming out of training camp with the intentions of winning the division. My only message from this point going forward is about winning the division next year. And I think that it can be honestly spoken because of what I saw out of the playoff games going forward.
We're sponsored by Miller Lite, official beer of the Chicago Bears. Tastes like Miller Time Chicago. Tom Thayer, I'm Jeff Joniak. Thanks to Joe Flam. Thanks for listening, and please subscribe now to the Chicago Bears official app, Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Bear down, everybody.